Ready?
Good morning.
My name's Andrew Chewin. I'm a surveyor with IMS and SAMS. IMS, originally from Australia. I started my Marine career in the Australian Customs Service. I was dual qualified as engineer and a master. And the funny thing for people from the US, the Australian Customs Marine Fleet at the time, we had 8 boats and there was 48 of us covering the whole Australian coastline. So we were quite busy, but we also worked with the Navy and local police, etc. But a little bit different to, I think, Coast Guard's over 10,000 or more. I'm not sure how many. But anyway, we were quite busy with our 6 little boats and 2 other little small tenders. So basically how I got into super yachts was we pulled in on a customs boat after a patrol. We'd been out for about 4 weeks and come into port called Cairns, which is up near Great Barrier Reef. And there was a big yacht there. It was about 55 meters. And there was about 12 crew on there and all the crew got off. And I said, oh, that looks like a cool job. How do you get a job there? And I said, well, go to Fort Lauderdale and, you know, get a job. So all these kids went off and they all bought a house. I thought, that sounds like a good idea. So I thought, okay, I'm going to change careers. So I spoke to the customs people and said, I might take a few months off if you don't mind. So I came over to America and never went back. So super yachts, I started as a second engineer. I was lucky enough to get a run on a boat. It was not as easy as I expected to get in. And I worked up from deckhand, second engineer, up to a captain within about 18 months, I think it was. So I worked as a captain for 10 years. And then when I started my family, I got off the boats. So my certificate was Master Class 4, 3,000 gross tons yachts, which is unlimited oceans up to, I guess it's about 250 feet to be conservative. The largest shot I drove was about 180 feet. From then, once I went ashore, I thought, you know, I need to do something that involves marine business. So I started off doing small craft surveys, and then I was fortunate enough that some super yacht surveyors that I'd met along the way were willing to mentor me. So I started out, I still work for the same company. Basically, super yacht surveying is a team job. You don't do it by yourself. It's not something you'd want to contemplate by yourself. So I'll start my little... Next, let's go there. Okay, so what is a super yacht? Super yacht is a privately owned, professionally crewed sailing or motor yacht over 24 meters or 79 feet. The vessel can be strictly for private use or for charter. Most of these, actually all these photos are boats that or yachts that I have worked on or consulted for or been a technical manager. Now, value of a boat like that, you're looking at probably high 70s, $80 million. So obviously, there's a lot of liability involved. You've got to be careful. There's a lot to it. What I'd like to do is just give you an overview of super yachts. It's a different scenario, obviously, to yacht and small craft, but basically the same principles, same types of surveys. It's just on a different scale. Okay, largest privately owned super yacht is about 590 feet. That value is probably, I don't know, 400 million. I wouldn't want to speculate. We predominantly work, our field is 40 meters to 80 meters, and we work basically out of Fort Lauderdale, but we travel quite a lot. There's a lot of surveys that are in Europe, for instance, in summer. So we'll fly as a team over to the boat and do our surveys over there or New York, Savannah, wherever. It's wherever we can haul the boat out or wherever it's located at the time, obviously. Okay, so just a few super yacht statistics, mainly for US audience. So the average price paid for a boat is 11 million. These average length overall is about 40 meters, so gross tonnage 312 feet. There were 522 super yachts sold between 2013 and 2017. So that's an awful lot of surveys in this field. There's quite a lot of companies in Europe that do it. And there's probably, in the US, there's probably four or five main teams. There's probably three predominantly that the brokers use. It's a niche market, I guess you could say. Of all those super yachts sold, 27% Italian, I think, US built as well. You've got Delta, who's probably the major manufacturer here, Christensen, Westport. Westport are prolific. They make quite a few yachts, as you know. And the larger yachts, this one here is Italian, CRN. The Germans and the Dutch are predominantly the larger yacht manufacturers. Larsen is a military or German Navy manufacturer, which translated into yachts, and they make the real monsters from, you know, 60 meters and up. Their latest one is at 130 meters, just launched. Okay, so types of surveys on the super yacht. A pre-inspection or a buyer's appraisal. This is what I like to do. It's normally a potential buyer will see a yacht and thinks, okay, is it worth taking a run at the boat? Sometimes some of these yachts may be a distress sale, or, you know, it's been sitting idle for 2 or 3 years, or maybe it's just an owner that just wants to go up to another level. So the pre-inspection is more of normally one or two of us will fly out to the boat or wherever the boat is, and we'll spend a day or a couple of days on the boat. Obviously, you have to be invited to get on board. And then from that, we make an assessment of, okay, is the boat worth $50 million or is that's what it's advertised at? Because as you've probably seen quite a lot, a lot of people ask a lot more for their boats and what they're worth. And, you know, it could be worth that. So we'll go along and we'll look at the engine room and the build spaces and all the nasty spots and just see, okay, you can't do a sea trial or anything like that, but you can get, with experience, you know, you get a general impression of what the boat's worth and whether it is worth taking a run at it. So after that, then you inform the buyer and say, yeah, we think it's worthwhile, or it'll appraise quite close to what they're asking, or, you know, this is what we think you should offer for the boat. So then we move to the next level. So after that, the contract process is a little more complicated than just buyer and seller. I'll go into that a bit later. Once the buyer approaches, everything's done through a broker, obviously. If they want to go to the next level and survey the boat, then they need a 10% deposit. So, you know, the boats that we're looking at are normally average $20 to $40 million. So you're looking at quite a substantial deposit. Obviously, the deposit is to deter tire kickers, as everybody calls them. Same thing. Yeah. Daily rate. So daily rate plus travel. Yeah, nothing. It depends on your relationship with the buyer. I work for a lot of owners as a technical consultant. So I might already be on the payroll. So it's just something that you do. Like I'm a technical manager for a few yachts. If that owner decides that he wants to upgrade or go to another yacht, then we'll go out and just take a precursory look. Okay, so then once they pay a deposit, you go to the pre-purchase, haul out and sea trial. I'll go into that a bit more. And also we do the condition and valuation for insurance companies and the banks. A lot of these boats are mortgaged pretty heavily, but the owner's finance is, you know, the high net worth individuals, they get a pretty good mortgage rate. But the banks want to see, okay, is the boat worth that much? The same as what you do on a small craft, same type of thing. Another thing that we do, or I don't particularly do, but paint inspections. Sorry.
Evaluations or some market research on order.
Comparables. What the boats have been selling for. You have to go back quite a few years. It depends on type of vessel. And, you know, yeah, you can get a feel for the market. It's the same as what you do with the small vessels. It's just a different scale, that's all. Few more zeros. Sorry? You can't go to boats.com, you won't find it there. Paint inspections, I'll just touch on that briefly. To paint a 50-meter yacht, normally, generally they'll repaint the yachts every 5 years. Some yacht owners paint them every 3 years. A 50-meter yacht, you'll average probably $1 million for a paint job. So what we generally advise them, the owners, is get a paint inspector. So IMS are doing the course for the paint inspectors. Definitely need someone that's accredited. There's a lot of liability with it, and it's very subjective. You know, one man's good paint job is another man's bad paint job. You know, it just depends on the day, the conditions, etc. I do have a pretty funny story. There was a sailboat that I was the owner's rep for in the yard. They had the hull painted blue. It's a 120-foot sloop. It happened to be take your kids to work day. So my daughter, who was 9 at the time, I said, you got to tag along. We've got to go look at a boat. So on the way to the yard, I get a phone call from the captain. The captain says, hey, they painted the blue yesterday. I'm not real happy with it, but they're pressuring me to sign. What do they want you to sign? Well, acceptance for the paint. And I said, why do they want to do that? Well, they said, you know, it's going to delay your haul out if you don't sign the acceptance. I said, well, I'm half hour out, just wait. So he waited, and the project manager was standing like, come on, hurry up and sign it. So anyway, we walked up the steps because the scaffold's probably 3 levels high to get the sloop up high enough to paint it. And my daughter walks up. She said, Daddy, what are all those little spots? I said, that's fish eyes. So the project manager was further off. And I said to the captain, I said, could you hear what she just said? He goes, yeah, yeah, I was wondering about that. I said, well, why would you sign an agreement for paint when it's obviously not right? So I guess the goal of the yard was for him to sign off so that they could get another reshoot but not have to pay for it. They knew they were going to have to do a reshoot, but once he'd signed that agreement that I accept the paint, then bad luck. If you want to paint it again, it's on him. So I said to my daughter, just stand there for a second. So I said to the project manager, all right, get the boss down here. I need to talk about this because we're not accepting the paint. Well, I can't understand why. I'm like, okay, let's just wait for a few minutes. So the higher ups come down, and there was 2 or 3 guys turn up on the scaffold. Why won't you accept the paint? And I said, well, I don't want to embarrass you, but Juliana, tell them what you see on the paint. I said, she goes, fish eyes? I'm like, yeah, that's it. So there was a nice blend of fish eye in the blue hull. So, you know, you can imagine that's not good enough, particularly for anybody. So made them paint the boat again. But it was pretty funny because they, you know, you don't even have to be a good inspector. That's basically my point, is you've got to be careful, and everybody comes across it in the yards where the yard's going to, you know, get you to sign something so they can move on to the next level. Anyway, so that. You know, I was a little bit worried about that. I thought that they might say, you know, you can't bring kids here. Well, technically, I probably shouldn't have, but, you know, I was comfortable in that environment. Okay, sea trial. So the importance of the sea trial, as part of the contract, all the sales contracts are done on a MEBA form, standard MEBA form, which is Mediterranean Yacht Brokers Association. So it's about a 5-6 page contract. The seller allows the buyer to do a sea trial after a 10% deposit. The buyer, after the sea trial, can reject the vessel. If there's anything that they don't like during the sea trial, then they can get their 10% deposit back. But you have 24 hours. So after the sea trial, you have 24 hours to reject the vessel or accept and move on to the condition survey. So it's quite important time-wise, and you know, sea trial, you obviously have to be pretty thorough. Sometimes the order is changed depending on schedule of haul outs, etc. When the survey starts, it just depends on the yard or the owner or the captain. But normally we want to do the sea trial first. We have had sea trials where boats have been rejected, and then of course you get the back and forth problems. I had a vessel that I was the owner's rep for, but the sale was about to be rejected because the owner or the buyer was sitting in the main salon and there was a vibration. So the boat was in Europe. I got a call from the owner's rep in Moscow and they said, can you please go to Nice? So I jumped on a plane that day, got to Nice the next day, got picked up, went on the sea trial. So what's the problem? So we went through and there was one chair in the middle of the main salon that was vibrating and you could hear the noise and it was coming through the wood and everything else. So I went down to the engine room and old school, earmuffs on, screwdriver, big screwdriver. Just went around. I heard the vibration in the main salon of what it was, and the frequency was quite rapid. And went into the engine room, went around and just listened to all the pipes. Took a couple of hours. And then there was a hydraulic oil tank with a return line, a metal pipe vibrating against the tank that the supports had shifted. So cut up a piece of rubber, put the rubber in between the pipe and the tank, went back upstairs, said to the captain, come back down, tell us if you can hear the noise. So, nah, what did you do? I said, oh, we'll talk about it later. So basically that saved the sail. The vibration was gone. Obviously we fixed the pipe situation later, but it was something simple like that was going to stop. It was a $10 million deal. Ended up, the deal went through because it wasn't anything to worry about. But it's just, that's just basically a different pair of eyes, I guess. So then sea trial. Okay, so sea trial, there's a lot going on in the sea trial. There's a lot of people involved. We generally would have on a 50 meter vessel at least 3 surveyors. We always have an engine surveyor, a separate entity, and also an electrical surveyor, because there's a lot of electrical systems, switchboards, generators, etc. To keep the condition survey going and meeting deadlines, then we bring in specialists to do that. There's a lot of liability, I guess, with engines. So we have a Caterpillar. If it's Caterpillar, you have a Caterpillar do it. Northern Lights for the generators, that's predominantly what we see here. There's a lot of MTU, of course, as well. So they'll come in, put their computers on, and we will run the sea trial based on what the engine manufacturer recommends. Same as what you do small craft, run through the rev ranges, wide open throttle, and record everything. And then the engine surveyor releases his separate or her separate survey report. While this is going on, the surveyors, you're checking out steering flat, rudder room, bilges, stabilizer compartments, hydraulic leaks, anything that you can see. We do decibel readings through the interior, because obviously the interior is quite important on these large yachts. And we've got, the standard is 4 hours. The sea trial is not allowed to take over 4 hours. We have had people come on thinking that it's going to be a picnic. And so the buyer will say, well, can I bring my wife and my kids and my grandmother? And so we have had people that show up, and okay, that's up to the captain of the seller if he'll let them on. Sometimes it's okay, but normally it's obviously all business, so we try and get it done as quick as we can. Weather dependent as well. It can get quite rough. Basically we run through all the systems. At the end of the day, we'll have a surveyors meeting, get together, and then if there's anything untoward, you normally pick it up straight away in a survey. If there's any engine problems, etc., normal situation. So if there's anything serious, there's always a lead surveyor. So the lead surveyor will talk to the buyer or the broker and advise them, look, this is what we found. Do you want to move forward or accept or reject? So you have to have a pretty good reason to reject the vessel. Obviously failure of the engines or leaks, something. It's got to be pretty serious. We've had people that have rejected the vessel based on the smell, grey water smell in the accommodation, or decibel readings too high, the vessel's too loud, too much vibration. So that's actually acceptable. Sometimes it may be that the buyer's significant other walks on and doesn't like the interior, but that's not enough to reject the vessel. So then they need to find something else to get their deposit back. So then we move on to the actual survey once the vessel is accepted. So 24 hours is not a lot of time. So the brokers, you will have a lot of phone calls, a lot of back and forth if it's close. If it's something obviously catastrophic, then it's pretty much that's done. We pack up and we go home. All right, so actually we surveyed this boat in the Med, and we had to do it all at anchor because the owner or the seller was wanted by authorities for not paying bills. So we weren't allowed to go ashore, so that we get ferried to the boat every day. And everything's extremely hot because everything's operating, running. Okay. Also, on the sea trial, what I forgot to mention, we'll have a vibration specialist as well. That's always a good it'll give the buyer a baseline for if they do go through with the boat, but it's also good to pick up other things that you can't really see here at the time of the sea trial. Well worthwhile. Engine mounts can be a big deal. After normally about 8 years on the bigger engines, 6 to 8 years, you probably need to replace them. That's standard. Also, I forgot to mention on with the electrical specialist. So you have the switchboard. Let's go back. There's obviously a lot of electrical on board because you've got generators that are probably 100 kilowatts or more. Norm standard have two plus an emergency generator, which is normally located up top for the vessels, commercial vessels over 50 meters. So we test changeover between shore power and generators, see what the synchronization's like. Sometimes there's problems where you can't switch from shore power, or there's reverse polarity, all that deal. Normally the board should pick it up. Sometimes the board won't pick it up, so there could be a fault there. The electrician will go through, measure sine waves, sine curves, etc. Look for dust, build up in the switchboard, hot spots. They'll use their cameras, thermal imaging cameras, and that's a whole other specialty that normal condition surveyors stay away from, and they give their own report at the end. During the sea trial, obviously performance monitoring, but we're looking at all the electronics and navs the same as you do small craft. Same thing, just different scale. Okay, etiquette. One of the big things with the yachts, etiquette is quite important. You'll see as you're working on a vessel that's, all vessels, you need to be polite and pay respect to the captain. Even more so on the yachts, you will come across a lot of captains that are very, very tough to deal with because they're looking at losing their job at the end of the survey. And so etiquette's a big deal. First thing, we always have an opening meeting, have all the crew in the wheelhouse or whatever suitable, because you're probably dealing with 12 crew minimum. Always remember that it's their house, is where they live 24/7. The crew are like, don't help yourself to coffee or anything like that. Wait until you'd be invited. It's very important. It'll help the survey go a lot better if you pay attention to that. Never wear shoes. Never on a deck. If you want to wear shoes, bring some booties or ask the boat for some booties. Never wear them on the interior. We'll go into that a bit later. Meal times. If you're fortunate, then you'll eat on the boat with the crew. Normally they'll have the crew. You'll eat in shifts, same as on a commercial ship, and the food's always pretty good. But don't assume that you're going to get fed. Don't be using all the toilets on board. They'll designate a toilet for you to use. You're looking at all the bathrooms are quite ornate. Gold, faucets, marble, onyx, etc. So, you know, you can spill some soap onto the marble, and that's not a good thing for a lot of the stewardesses don't like that. So, you know, obviously you have to be cognizant of your surroundings. Just be aware. But it's a big deal. Normally, with the captain, you negotiate the sea trial when he wants to do it, when it works for him, tide, etc. Same thing. Dock line handlers, all that's important as well. You ask the captain to designate who's going to be with each surveyor. So if you've got a team of four, you want to have someone with you at all times. Don't be wandering around the boat by yourself. You can cause a lot of damage quite easily. Don't have keys hanging off your jeans, wristwatches. It's a big deal. Probably take your wristwatch off. The fine wood on the door jams, there's a lot of nice stone, belt buckles, like you'll lean up on a bar and you could crack the onyx. So you have to be... Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so normally what I do in that situation is I'll ask the engineer for his tape. And the engineer will come out with a metal tape. Right. Okay. So there's ways around it, and that's so that's why you just got to be nice to the captain and the engineer or the crew, and they can be a lot of the time they'll do the survey for you, because what happens is I'll always grab a deckhand, and because my job I'm the bilge rat. I normally start at the forepeak, work all the way back, and that's where you see most of the problems are, is underneath all the nice stuff. So after a few hours, you have a rapport with the crew member. It's the same for the engineers, second engineers. Normally the second engineer is good because he's already jaded because the chief's making him polish everything. So you can find a lot out from the crew, and they'll lead you to where the problems are 90% of the time. A lot of them, particularly, I use this boat as an example, because they had so much uncertainty about their position on board and their future, they wanted the boat to sell. So you'll find out a lot more information than you probably should, and then you follow up on it, of course. Interior. So as you can see, quite elaborate. You don't want to be coming up from the engine room, walking straight in onto that carpet. The carpet in that area, you're probably looking at silk carpet, handmade, $100,000. So, I just try and avoid it if possible. The stewardess, I would stick with the stewardess when you walk through these areas, because like the furniture, it might have gold leaf on the wood. You just never know. So you don't want to be bumping into it and moving stuff. The other thing is hatches. You'll have a lot of hatches that are in stone floors and stone marble. They all have metal edges, or some of them don't have metal edges. It's just purely stone, and that's your only access to the bilge. So always get a crew member to do that. We have had stone crack before by the crew, You want to be pretty careful because you don't want to spend a couple of $1,000. Plus, you might break the stone hatch, but if it's part of a piece that's 8-foot by 4-foot slab that matches, book match the rest of the slab around it, then it's very expensive. So always have the crew member move any hatches. Carpet, same thing. To get to stabilizers, normally the stabilizer compartments on the smaller boats is under a bed. So always have the crew member lift. The girls, the stewardesses normally use those areas to store bed linens, crew uniforms, things like that. Have them all, empty that out. Don't touch it. Don't move stuff. Because sometimes, like even the hatches in the stabilizer compartments, if there's been a hose let go, then straight away oil's going to come up. So it's better if someone else removes the hatch because there's obviously oil on the hatch. So always let the engineers do that. Just tell them ahead of time. Like in the crew meeting, we'll normally say, okay, we want to look at stabilizer compartments, take the hatches off because they're watertight compartments, sometimes have watertight doors, depends how big the boat is. Black tank, gray tank, freshwater tank, oil tanks. We check as many tanks as we can. Random sampling. Black tank's always a problem. Gray tank, as you know, same thing. There's always something going on in those tanks, as you know, if they're not cleaned correctly or annually. So that's also important. Freshwater tanks. There is a boat builder here in the US, aluminum, that runs their fire main through the freshwater tank. That has a problem after 5-6 years of pitting, that actual pipe that transits through the freshwater. So that's something to look at. So always take a look in the tanks. It can tell a lot about the boat and how much maintenance they do on the boat. And that's the other thing, like this boat here, for instance, everything looks fantastic because that's the guest areas. But underneath the surface, there could be a lot of issues. Just because it's a nice, shiny white yacht doesn't mean that it's not not a lot of problems in the engine room or in the machinery spaces. Also, looking for water leaks, the same as what you would do on a smaller boat. Air handlers are always a problem. On a bigger boat, over 50 meters, you've probably got a minimum of 20 to 25 air handlers. Some of the bigger yachts can be up to 100.
How extensively do you review ship's plans and schematics and mapping out your day of regular work?
Well, normally we find out about the survey a week before, but we can say to the broker, can we have scantling plans, hull plans, depending on the age of the boat and material, like a steel boat. If it's, you know, over 10 years old, then we'll want to do ultrasound around the hull when we haul out. So we'll ask for the hull plan, scantling plan. And then we can also see whether there's been plate replaced because it doesn't line up with the plan. So that's always a good indicator as well. But so when we do get on board, that is part of the survey, is going through some of the documentation. Just make it sure it's on board. Some boats, the older boats, may not have it. And you know, the buyer needs to be aware of that because maintenance-wise. It's just another interior space. As you can see, there's a lot of stone there. I wouldn't hesitate to guess what that costs, but it'd be over $100,000. So flashlights, don't be walking around with a flashlight and drop it on the stone. It will crack the stone. Onyx is a bad one because it's so brittle. You have to be very careful. But you just look at the leather couches and the seats. You can brush up against them pretty easily and tear something. So you just got to be really careful. And that's why I always say have someone with you, because you tend to pay more attention when you have a scout with you. If you're just walking around by yourself, you might, you know, wander off. We'll do audio-visual TVs on a big yacht. You probably have at least 20, 15, 20. So you'll check all the TVs. You get the crew turn everything on. Sound audio is a big thing with most owners. They want to know how good the sound system is for entertaining. So you'll check all the speakers. You could actually, on the bigger yachts, probably bring in an AV specialist for that as well. Like when you're talking, say, a $40 million yacht, you know, spending, I think I worked out, it's about 0.1% is the survey cost compared to what the boat's selling for. So at the end of the day, it's money well spent, same as every survey. I'll talk about, we take notes and similar situation. Every day you get a multitude of notes. A few of the guys that I work with will voice record every day. I normally do my voice recording at the end of the day. We get, we send our voice recordings off to a girl that we have in the office that types everything up daily. If you don't do it every day, you'll really fall behind, because a lot of the bigger yachts, you might spend 10 days straight on this particular boat. So, you know, one day fades into another pretty quickly. So every day you should be doing your notes. That's something to keep on top of. And the voice recordings is quick and efficient. Normally I do it per area, or, you know, per bilge. What I normally do is, just my general practice is, I'll just sit down there and take it all in, because there's a lot of pipes, there's a lot going on, especially in the bigger yachts, 200 footers and above. Just sit there, have a look around, just listen, sit, take it all in, and then start doing your notes. Even the voice recording is good for that, because you can just sit, and most of the equipment you're familiar with, and just roll through it. But also at the same time, you're also looking. Obviously, touch and feel. You know, telltale signs, leaks, grounding conductors, things like that. You want to have a look at everything.
Is it all separate reports, or is it all put together as one report at the
end? It's all put together as two reports. So there'll be two parts of the survey. You'll have your condition survey, which is, you know, it's basically listing all the equipment on the boat, what's been tested, what hasn't. And then we have a recommendations report. So anything that turns up in your condition survey, you write another report for recommendations.
Same way, we do it, priority 1, 2, 3.
Safety items first. And then 1, 2, 3. And also you might want to tell the owner capital expenditure items, like say the paint's 8 years old. You're going to need a paint job. So that's going to cost $1 million, 1.2. I just did a spec for a 85 meter in just going to the yard in Germany to review their yard list, and their paint was quoted at 4.5 million, which was about 1.5 too high. So a lot of the time, based on our experience, we'll be invited to look at the spec just to go through things like that. Doesn't need to be, no. Just, it's all about how good you look. Yeah, I think the average is probably 5. It would be a very fastidious person that would want to paint it every 3 years. And sometimes that could just be the captain saying to the owner, you know what, boss, we need to paint every 3 years because I need 4 months in the yard. So, you know, that's where a technical consultant comes in, because you can get. So if I was on, working for a big, large yacht owner, and he said to me, look, do I need to paint? I said, well, let's call these guys. So you get Reed Consulting or someone from Europe. Most of the more recognized paint inspectors are in Europe. Get them in, gloss meter, check everything. The equipment's quite expensive, and there's a lot of liability to it. So I would advise them, fly someone in. They'll do a core sample if they can, and then you decide if you're going to paint. Survey specialists, as you can see, a few of the pictures, there's a lot going on in these engine rooms, quite well laid out. You would have like Mr. Penske's, one of his older yachts was stainless steel from top to bottom. Actually makes it really easy to find problems, but normally, like on that particular boat, they would have a stewardess in there polishing, and the engineers, two engineers, like keeping that boat. It recently sold 6 months ago. It's still in premium condition, but it's all about maintenance. Okay. The survey specialists themselves, they separate entities. They'll charge, write their own report. We combine it with our report. They normally, we will suggest somebody, but it's up to the buyer. We'll give them a list of, okay, there's these three guys or et cetera. You don't want to be too tied up with that. I went over no shoes on deck, et cetera, crew area, mealtime. The boats run pretty regimented. 12 o'clock's lunch, 5 o'clock they finish, 3 o'clock's break. So you be cognizant of that as well. They'll tell you when they want to go on a break. Just play along with their rules. Sometimes we'll stay later for the survey if the captain agrees. Depends on their at the time, their schedule at the time. Like if it's in the middle of the season and they got a charter coming up, then you know they want everybody off by 5 o'clock, maybe 4 o'clock. So you just follow what they do. Sometimes we're lucky, we'll stay till 7 or 8 o'clock at night. Just depends on the situation and what the speed of the survey is. Sometimes you have the brokers that are like, we need to get this done in 5 days, 6 days. They'll give you a limit on how long you can be on board. The other part about the interior is artwork. Obviously, there's a lot of nice art pieces on these boats, statues, etc. So be very careful of that. What you will find is, unless it's a super, super wealthy person, the insurance companies advise the clients to get a fake or a identical of the Picasso. The Picasso will be in storage somewhere, but they'll have a replica on the boat because the liability is so high. You know, if there's a fire, that $1 million piece of art goes up. So we don't, obviously that's nothing that we do. Normally the art will go with the buyer. The seller. That's all part of written up in part of the contract is, you know, what's omitted and what's included. So the exclusions list, that comes up first. But basically what I'm saying is don't touch it. Especially the statues, because it's all, it's just mounted. It's not, a lot of it's not bolted down. It's just mounted with museum glue. So it can move quite easily too. And you'll see quite a lot of ornate glass statues, etc. Okay, during the survey, we go through, same as I said a few times already, similar situation. All the water separators, we want to make sure that the crew know how to use it. It's funny how many, like it's a regulation and a lot of the guys don't know how to use them effectively. We make sure that they test it because they have to do it monthly anyway, but it's also a good way to find out how much the engineer actually knows. You'd be surprised. Fuel separators, they don't like running them because they take a long time to clean. Yeah, I always look at the oil record book. Yeah, make sure, because that'll... In a condition survey, we won't look at the ISM, ISM's International Safety Management for Commercial Vessels. That's not part of the survey, it's like separate audit. But I'll look at the oil record book just to see whether the engineer's on top of it, because that'll carry over to the new owner as well. Because oil record book has to be filled in every week and signed by the master at the end of each page. So, yeah, and make sure that what's in the waste oil tank lines up with what's in the book, because down the road you could get fined. Yeah, so you got to be careful about that. Killer plants. I'll have a look at ISM deficiencies. I will look at if they allow you access to it. Sometimes we'll look at their management system. Just have a quick look. I'll look at error messages on their management control system on the boat in the engine room. You know, it's always a dead giveaway if you've got a bilge alarm going off all the time or a fire alarm, you know, so it's worth looking. The ISM stuff, they may not let you look at it. They're not obliged to, I guess. I'm not sure. But normally... Yeah. Right. What I'm saying is some of it's electronic. So, you know, it's part of having a good rapport with the crew. Most of the crew will show you. We haven't pushed it too hard. The other thing on the handover is you want to make sure that all that information is transferred to the new owner. That's part of the contract, but you'd be surprised sometimes people don't do that. Yeah. Yeah, so it's worth talking about. I didn't talk too much about haul out, but same scenario, bigger scale. Ultrasound, hull plate. Sometimes there's a few guys in our team that are certified to do it. I'm not certified to do it, so I don't do it. But before the survey, we'll make sure that wherever they're hauling out, that we've got a cherry picker or moving scaffold, because you're looking at the water line's probably 5 stories high once you get into dry dock or more. So obviously that's where you want to be doing your ultrasound, is around the water line. And we'll also target black tanks, frames of the black tanks, grey tanks, etc. Not the normal trouble area is forepeak, bottom of the forepeak, always a good one. We have a rejected vessel based on thickness of plate. So you want to have a recognized individual that does that. So if you've got a boat that's supposed to have 12 mil plate and it comes back at 4 mil, obviously it's more than 25%. You want to have the right backup, because there's so much money involved. Okay, this guy's meter reads, he's recognized inspector, the shell plate, there's a shell plate deficiency. Then it's up to the owner to decide. It gets back to negotiation there, because we have had boats that have had deficient plate, but they have moved forward based on the price of the vessel. Another interesting part is tenders and toys. So this is a 45-foot Midnight Express. This is a tender to a 240-foot yacht, 5,400 horsepower, Evinrude or Mercury's. So these guys, the bigger yachts, they'll tow a tender. So that, like I said, this one's towed behind a 240-foot yacht. A friend of mine's the captain of it. He really dislikes this boat, because this takes 2 crew, if not 3, to hook it up to the tow line. Also, we will inspect the tender as well if it's part of the deal. A lot of the time it will go to the next boat, hopefully, because it's just another day and a half or more. So with these tenders, they tow them. So there's a problem there. You got to look at the tow eye, whether the bracket's got a backing plate. Even damage to the hull. If you know that they tow a tender, you know that tender's hit that boat quite a few times. There's things like that. The average, like a 50-meter yacht, so 160-foot, 165 feet, the average yacht's towing now is about a 35-foot tender, Intrepid, Contender. It's standard now. 10 years ago, it wasn't. We all had 20-foot inflatables on the boats, you know, in their own spot on the boat. But now space is a premium, that a lot of tenders aren't stored on board, or they're stored in garages. Obviously, you need a pretty big crane to lift this one. I guess 12,000 pounds or more. So you've got to have a fair bit of deck space to be able to store that. I have been on yachts that you can drive these straight into the garage. So quite a big yacht, obviously. And they also have side garages, gantry doors with gantry cranes, and they'll pick the boat up, bring it into the garage, set it down. I've also done surveys for Captain, where they'll get a custom tender made and he'll send me the drawings, because the tender's getting made in the US and the boat's getting made, the big boat's getting made in Italy or Germany. Can you measure the
dimensions because I've got 2-inch clearance to fit it in the garage. So that's pretty tricky because your dimensions have to be bang on, and it's not good enough to take it from the drawing from the builder. You have to physically measure it. So it's quite important, especially with the rigid inflatables have fold down consoles, etc. So you want to make sure that there's no no brackets or rod holders or something like that sticking up that'll hit the garage. So that's quite technical. These things here are called C-bobs. So these run at 15 grand a piece. We normally, what you would do here is, we normally wouldn't make the crew get them out and use them because it depends when the survey is, but by all means, if you want to get them to test them, do it, but don't test them yourself. You'd probably hurt yourself. These go under water about 10, 15 feet, and then they have a system set up, so a depth sensor, so it'll bring you back up, basically just for diving or snorkeling. Rich person's way to go diving. Here I have, this is the tender bay on a 60-meter yacht. This is in front of the wheelhouse. They store in this tender bay 21-foot rigid inflatable. So basically what I wanted to talk about here is you're on a commercial vessel. There's a lot of dangerous things happening as well. This particular boat, there's a crane. You see that there's a crane just here. The crane wasn't working. Hydraulic leaks everywhere. So they said, oh, we can't launch the tender because the crane doesn't work. I said, what about, can you open the door? They're like, yeah, we can open the door. So then they opened the door, and then they got the deck, got a crane from shore to lift the tender. And then the deck crew member jumped in. And this has the hydraulic ram, but also has a safety ram with a safety pin. Locking pin, I guess. And he didn't put the pin in. He goes, you jumping in here? I'm like, no. Can you put the pins in and I'll think about it? Because already he's got hydraulic problems on his crane. I don't know what's going on with the door. If they're not going to fix the crane, are they going to fix the door? So I didn't get in there because it's not worth it. So they got the yard crane to pull the tender out, took it out, and anyway, closed the door. But, you know, the crew, so he's not even caring, not even looking. Commercial, you'd have a hard hat, I guess, right? There's no safety in place, and you'll see that a lot on the yachts. It's quite cavalier. It's not as commercial as proper commercial, and Coast Guard, you know that too. So it's always something to be wary of. There has been several incidents where crew members have been hurt severely or worse from hatches closing. They're quite big because that hatch for a 21-foot tender, it's probably 23-foot long hatch, okay? So, and that's probably a smaller one. Transom doors, swim platforms. Some of the transom doors, if you're looking at a big yacht that's got a beam of 24, 25 feet, that transom door is quite substantial as well. Obviously, stay out of the way. This is a boat that I did a condition survey. I actually did it for two clients. That boat was a very nice boat. Expedition was converted tug at 1965. Quite a nice vessel, but it was going for a pretty good price. This is one that probably had hull plate. I never did the haul out. I took a look at the boat and saw how much work needed to be done and basically said to the owner, well, if you've got $5 million to spend and not want to see it, then this is the boat for you. But it depends. He said, well, I could probably get it done for $3 million. So anyway, this particular client bought the boat and he's only just started using it 2 years later for a lot more than what even $5 million, like I thought. So anyway, no matter how much you advise them or let them know, you know, it's up to them. So what does a typical survey cost? Always question. Now, basically, we charge out at a daily rate. For example, 180 to a 200-foot yacht. We have probably three or four surveyors, 5 or 6 days, including the sea trial. That doesn't include your engine surveyor, which is probably 2 days, maybe three, depends, emergency generator as well. And then your electrical survey, he probably needs 2 or 3 days because he's doing the batteries and everything else as well, load testing. So team of 3 or 4 surveyors for 10 days, you're looking at $30,000, $40,000 if your daily rate's $1,000 a day. It's quite substantial, but as you figure it out, if the boat's selling price is $20 million, you know, it's 0.1% or less the survey cost, which is definitely worthwhile if you're going to go that far and spend that much money on a yacht. So there's not a lot of companies that do the larger yachts. There's it's hard to say, but it's definitely something that you need to be experienced with. Most of the surveyors that I've worked with or know have been in the business for 20 or 30 years. I work with a family team down in Florida, and their father was one of the principal surveyors from way back, and they've come up through the ranks. They've worked on yachts, etc. Yeah.
When you're talking about a survey price tag that size, do you get a new client? Do you get a portion before you start?
Yeah. Normally, especially if we're going to fly, if we're going to go to Europe or Italy, we will get, we'll ask for probably 50% up front because we're missing out on a lot of work here as well if you're out of town. Like this particular team that I work for, I'm their extra guy if they're doing a trip so that they can bang it out quicker, because most of the guys don't want to be away more than a week. So we'll bring on extra people to get through that. And then if they're overseas or elsewhere, then I'll cover some of their boats here and start on it. So I might do 2 or 3 days by myself and then the team comes in, or vice versa. It just depends on what we have going on at the time, because it comes in waves. You know, October's boat show in Fort Lauderdale, Monaco's in September. There's normally a lot of activity after that. So, you know, we could be flat out for 3 months, and then January, February, like, it's pretty quiet. Just depends. And when the economy changes too, it has a big effect on boats this value selling. A lot of what we do is builders inspections. We travel to the yard once a month or every couple of weeks, depending on the stage of the build. We'll look at build specs as well. From my side, I'll look at what works efficiently on other yachts and just make sure that the builders allowed for that. Just make sure that the client gets a better boat, because a lot of stuff they won't hide, plus the agreed contract, making sure that the work's continuing on a good schedule and what they said it's going to cost. You'd be surprised, you probably wouldn't be surprised, but a lot of builders will, you know, rob Peter to pay Paul. We know all about that. This particular yacht was getting built up in Canada, and they were taking too long to finish it. So it got brought down to Florida on a ship, and I finished the last 3 months of that, just the final fit out, just to get it done. Otherwise, they wouldn't have got their med season in. Refit inspection, same thing. We'll travel to the boat, make sure that the yard bills obviously creep up quite quickly. It's very difficult to keep a handle on that. Normally, the owner will have a project manager as the owner's rep, maybe two, depends on how big. Sometimes the bigger yachts, they'll have 3 owner's reps, one for engineering, one for exterior, one for, the owner's captain. So they have another pair of eyes. The surveyors will come through, making sure that the builder's on target and on budget. Another tough one. The other thing we do is, or what I do, part of my business is safety audits. As an owner's rep, technical consultant, I'll do a management audit where we'll just look at crew, how they're doing, whether they're keeping the boat the way they should, whether the engineer's doing his job, doing his oil record book, you know, making sure that there's nothing regulatory that they're going to fall foul on, making sure that they're ready if the boat's about to sell. The other thing is that I have done is making sure that it's ready for the owner. So a lot of owners will employ a captain to go buy the boat 2 days before he comes in to make sure that everything's as they want it. And that's normally a long-term captain that has worked for the particular client. Obviously, a nice job if you can get it. Maritime Labour Convention, that's a crewing issue, same as commercial. We'll do MLC 2006 audits, and that's just another paperwork exercise. What else have I got? Okay, this is a standard galley. That's a 240-foot boat. So this particular boat, that galley, they have 20 crew, sometimes 24 on charter, and they'll have more than 12 guests. It's a privately owned boat. Sometimes they'll have 16, 20 guests. So that galley's got to put out a lot of food. There is another boat that I represented that had the identical size galley adjacent to it, which was a kosher galley. So that was only for the owner. So basically you weren't allowed in there. It was pristine. His own chef would come in for that. So it's quite amazing some of the things that you will see. The certificate audits, quite important. Certificate of registration, you want to make sure everything's current. Same as you do with Coast Guard documentation, you want to make sure everything's there. Suez Canal, Panama Canal, load line, you want to make sure that they do have everything statutory correct. Safety construction certificates, the flags issue them, Lloyd's as well, Lloyd's Register. Safety radio certificate, IOPP for MARPOL. MCA code of compliance, large yacht code. Predominantly, the larger yachts are red flag vessels, which means British flag. So they have to follow the United Kingdom code of large yacht code. That's basically why I went with IMS to be recognized, was because of red flag yachts. Stability booklet. Make sure that the stability booklet, and it's been endorsed by the flag state. So it basically, it'll tell you if there's been any construction changes as well. You might have a 25-year-old boat that's had two extensions. So that's part of looking at the drawings, like builder's drawing, and then have a look at the boat. It's got a nice big swim platform out the back. You want to make sure that that's in the stability booklet. Any alterations to the vessel over, I think it's 5%. You need, 5% weight change. You need another stability booklet issued, inclining test, etc. And then make sure it's been stamped, signed off, so that the surveyors have come in from flag state or class and certified that. It's very important for insurance as well, because once the transaction's done, then the new owner would have to pay for that or make any changes that were required. A lot of the distressed boats will be out of class as well. So that's part of what you'll do in your initial survey, is just making sure that it's correct. Otherwise, if a boat's out of class, it could cost you a couple of $100,000 to bring it back into class. So the new owner obviously doesn't want to do that. Technically, the attorneys take care of that. They would make sure that before the transaction's done, that all the certificates are in place. So maritime attorneys hopefully will take care of that. But you need to check it, because they'll ask you what the dates are. You'll have to talk to the attorneys about that. Engine technical files, EIAPP. All engines come from the manufacturer with a little blue book. Costs about $4,500. It's got a red seal on it. It's required by class that each engine has their technical file. It's related to MARPOL regulations. That should be part of the transaction, so I always ask the engineers for that. A lot of the time they can't find it. Probably 50% of them can't find it. But that's another expense. That's $5,000 per engine. So you want to make sure that they have that. You know, the buyer, you don't want the buyer coming back to you later going, why didn't you ask for that? Because even though in the scheme of things, it's not a lot of money, but for them, but it is for us. Okay. A few of the other things I do. Loading surveys. Actually, so this is the last yacht I was captain of. That's down in Galapagos. That's a 50 meter fed ship. So it's, a lot of people call it the Rolls Royce of yachts. Okay, this particular vessel, this is a survey I did this year. The actual vessel I was captain of for 4 years. It was very coincidental. The boat was in the yard. This is 140 foot long. The boat was in the yard in South Florida, had a lot of plate work done. It's over 25 years old. And a lot of the, let's just say that a lot of plate work was replaced and the work went a little bit too far and the bill got up very high to the point where the owner found out and was like, okay, there's a problem. Sent another survey team from England in to look at this particular boat and they said, yeah, you probably should take it to another yard. So the owner's captain from his other boat said, let's take it to Pendennis in England. So they chartered their own ship and proceeded to ship it to England. So my job was, I got a call from a client I work for in Germany. He said, there's a 140-foot yacht in town. Can you go and do a survey to see if it's fit to be placed in the water to be towed to the port? It was a 2-mile tow. The boat was out of the water at the time. So I had to inspect to make sure that it would float, basically. There was no equipment. All the engines were there, but everything had been torn out. There's no electrical. There's no bilge pumps. It was basically gutted on the inside. When I went to the boat, I was quite distressed, I guess, because I'd actually lived on the boat for 4 years and they'd torn it up. It was quite sad because it was a very good owner, really nice gentleman. So the boat was obviously okay to tow. Had to do the report for that. We towed the boat, we got it to the ship, loaded it on the ship, then had to check, obviously, that it's strapped correctly and ready for sea, sign off on it, and then off it went to England, where it's probably about a year into another refit. Hopefully get sorted out. It's quite regular now that you will see a lot of yachts shipped as deck cargo now. This yacht used to do transatlantic twice a year. It has the legs to do it. You know, we'd go two fuel stops across, but it can do it. But it actually works out almost same price to ship it on a ship than actually on its own bottom. So it's more an economical thing. And plus the crew get time off. This is a 50 meter yacht. I do this twice a year. This is a loading survey in Antigua before it goes to the Med. Basically, the first time they lifted it, they did a lot of paint damage. So then I have a standing agreement with the management company that I'll be there when they lift the boat. So it also, you know, the cargo guys, commercial, if someone's paying attention and watching them, it also helps. So anyway, part of that is just a loading warranty survey they'll do. As you can see on the second photo on the right, it's going into a slot next to another 50 meter yacht. And by the time it was blocked and secured, there's probably, the closest it came was probably 2 inches. Very close, they didn't touch. It's It's amazing how these guys do it. They're very good. And obviously a lot of value, a lot of paint damage can happen. So that's why we're there, to make sure that that doesn't happen or report on it if it does. A lot of yachts ship these days as float on, float off. This is a job I did in Martinique last month, same boat. So this time it arrived from the Med float on, float off. Price was probably better. This is actually a better way to transport. You look there, the boat that I surveyed is there. So there's three, well, the first row are all 55 meters, second row are 50 meters, the last row is 50 meters. So you're looking at, I guess the average to ship those is $250,000. So that obviously a full ship, and you'll probably have three of those going into the Caribbean every season and three of them leaving, and then same in Port Everglades. There's one particular company that does it, that specializes in it, and it's quite a regular mode of transport now. 20 years ago, never used to be, but it allows, you know, fuel costs cheaper. They're not running up their engines too long. Crew get 2 weeks off. Crew's pretty happy about that. And then they meet the boat on the other side. Away they go. It's quite rapid how they load and launch. Once they start floating, they're all out. 2 hours maybe on a good day. So it's quite a quick operation. So we're normally there just to make sure that no one's bumping and grinding and NASCAR racing on the way up, which does happen. And that's the end. That's last boat down in Galapagos at anchor. That's all. Thank you for listening. And if you've got any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, and we'll talk to you later. Thank you. Yeah.
Just one thing I wanted to say before we break for coffee. It's worth noting, whenever we do a presentation anywhere, AXA and Abel are always happy to come out and offer their services for free. If you've got a coating problem, guys, put a hush for a minute, please. Guys, just a second. If you ever want advice on coatings, call AXA and Abel. I don't know where they are. I think they're down in Fort Lauderdale, maybe down in Florida. If you want to know, then they're always happy to fly out and give you an opinion on a coat job. Really, we're free. Happy to do it. I like this. I was my body.
They purchased all the company's really.